Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The announcement last week that the U.S. will restore diplomatic relations with Cuba was a dramatic shift from 55 years of tensions between the two nations. Long before Fidel Castro led rebels onto the streets to claim victory in 1959, another Cuban man brought the world to its knees, although Julio Lobo was an avowed capitalist. Lobo was an entrepreneur, an art collector, and lover of Hollywood starlets who pulled the perfect squeeze on the commodities market at the low point of the Depression. Lobo's large-scale bet against sugar prices falling cost the world market what would today be billions in paper losses. The business community was in an uproar. The U.S. government took action. Trading was suspended, and the president of the New York Stock Exchange forced to resign. To help better understand Lobo and the history of U.S.-Cuba relations, we reached into the archives for a conversation with John Paul Rathbone. His book, The Sugar King of Havana, The Rise and Fall of Julio Lobo, Cuba's Last Tycoon, reveals an economy built on sugar, supporting a glamorous and decadent society of elites. It's a much more complicated story than rampant greed toppled by revolution. Rathbone's mother grew up among the gracious homes, gleaming American cars, and humming sugar mills of pre-revolutionary Cuba. She ran in the same circles as the Lobo family. I asked John Paul Rathbone to tell us about his mother.
Although I have a very English name, Rathbone, my mother is Cuban. She's a Sanchez. So actually, I should be called John Paul Rathbone, E. Sanchez, if we were doing the full Spanish appellation. But she grew up in Havana, and she left Cuba before the revolution for reasons that have nothing to do with politics. And her parents were well-to-do. Her ancestors had been involved in sugar, like Julio Lobo. And her father ran a department store in the center of Havana. And she was a friend of one of Lobo's two daughters, in fact, the youngest one, Mary Luisa. So she moved in that rather gilded world and closeted world that young debutantes and children of the well-to-do did in Havana back in the 1950s.
And this is a world that really does seem to have evaporated in terms of what the revolution did and kind of erasing the past. But what you're doing is pulling out this story, Julio Lobo's story, which is in many ways a history of 20th century Cuba, its fortunes rising and falling with the price of sugar. So tell us a little bit about his origins.
Lobo was the child of immigrants from Venezuela, who, ironically, they were kicked out of Venezuela by another Castro, no relation to Fidel, called Cipriano Castro. And many years later, Lobo used to quip from exile, "The Castros have always had it in for us Lobos." And Lobo, in fact, he arrived in Havana in 1898 at the age of two. And he always considered himself fully Cuban, although he had Venezuelan origins. But in fact, Cuba, after the Wars of Independence, was a country of great immigration. And as they say in Spain, every Spaniard has a Cuban grandmother. And huge amounts of Spaniards, notwithstanding they just fought a war of independence against them, came to live in Cuba. So it had a lot of problems. The government was new. There was the overweening presence of the United States. But at the turn of the century, Cuba, in fact, was a place of great optimism and fantastic growth as well.
And this kind of commercial class that believed that wealth was the way to carry it forward.
It's slightly more complicated than that, but a lot of the Creole aristocracy had lost their fortunes in the Wars of Independence, and the island was a wasteland, basically, after the Wars of Independence. The concentration camp was, in fact, invented by the Spanish in Cuba then, just to give you a measure of how severe the tactics were. So there was a certain jaded idea towards a revolution, perhaps, and also a great feeling that having fought for their independence for nigh on 30 years, the way forward and also to reestablish kind of sovereignty was through wealth and the creation of wealth. And Cuba has always, in fact, ironically, given that it's a socialist country now, has always been a trading country by virtue of its strategic position in the Gulf and the fact that it's always traded sugar, so which is an international market and has been almost since its inception. So it's been a nation of traders and artists, I would say, and Lobo slotted into that very neatly.
We're talking with John Paul Rathbone. His new book is The Sugar King of Havana. It tells the story of the enigmatic Cuban businessman Julio Lobo, who made a lot of money off of that sugar market. He was from a wealthy family. He was sent off to school at Columbia, dropped out to learn the sugar trade at LSU, Louisiana State University. Now, let's talk about some of the things that he was able to pull off in this market. His business savvy grew quite a bit. In 1934, when the world was suffering with the Great Depression, Lobo pulled off a major coup in the market. Can you tick through that for us, please?
It's kind of complicated to run through, but basically it was a very subtle and rather brilliant plan that exploiting not a loophole, but some of the characteristics of the sugar quota that the U.S. had just established with Cuba, which established that Cuba would sell a certain amount of sugar each year to the United States. So basically what Lobo did is he sold all that sugar, and then his agents in the States bought it. And anyone betting against that sugar, going short the sugar price, were stuck with a problem because they couldn't actually buy any physical sugar to cover their short positions when the price of sugar started rising. So it was a sugar squeeze. By holding all the sugar, Loeb effectively forced the price of sugar up. And then when the shorts tried to cover their positions, they had to buy physical, but there was none physical sugar there. So that took the price even higher. So basically, what Lobo's life shows all the way through the Republican period up to the 1960s, and what turns the idea of Cuba as a victim very nicely on its head, is that he was as good at the speculative game as anybody else. He often beat others, especially North Americans or Europeans at their own game. And often it was to the benefit of Cuba.
Right.
So he played the game better, and he just goes to show some of the sophistication, the financial sophistication of the Cuban entrepreneurial classes in pre-revolutionary Cuba.
John Paul Rathbone, there are times when his life, as you've written it, they read like a movie script. He lived very opulently, but simply in his own way. He was close to Betty Davis, Joan Fontaine, a great friend and once a lover who ended up rejecting his offer of marriage. He once also filled his swimming pool at the estate at Tingoro with perfume when Esther Williams was expected. But he was also a bit of a loner and a sensitive soul in his way. Who do you think this man was at his heart?
Well, I think the Esther Williams anecdote is slightly misunderstood. I think it's really doubtful that he would have filled a swimming pool with perfume. And I did some rough sums.
I couldn't figure out how anyone would want to swim in it, actually.
Exactly. I mean, I did some rough sums, and he could easily have afforded it. It would have cost, I think, a few tens of millions of dollars to fill a 30,000-gallon pool with Chanel 5. But it's much more in character to have him gallantly sprinkling a few drops and then inviting Miss Williams to plunge into the pool. But he was essentially a loner. What really characterized him was his incredible will and determination. But he had great wit and great resources and manners that were honed into reflexes. And when he wanted to charm a bird out of the trees, he could. And he showed that in the way that he would treat very gallantly and gentlemanly Joan Fontaine or Betty Davis or any of the other women friends that he had. And I think what's notable is that he remained friends with them always. So they enjoyed his company, and he enjoyed their company too.
We're going to continue our earlier conversation with John Paul Rathbone. He's Latin American editor for the Financial Times and author of The Sugar King of Havana, The Rise and Fall of Julio Lobo, Cuba's Last Tycoon. We spoke with him when the book was first published and pulled it from the archives to better understand the economy of Cuba and its relationship to the United States before the revolution of 1959. Stick with us. We're going to continue the conversation after a short break. This is Word of Mouth. Word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're back with Word of Mouth and an archive conversation with John Paul Rathbone. He's Latin American editor for the Financial Times. His book, The Sugar King of Havana, follows the rise and fall of Julio Lobo, a tycoon once so powerful that he manipulated the price of sugar on the world market, but also a man who so truly loved Cuba that he continued to invest in it even after Castro came into power. We left off talking about the character of Julio Lobo, who was an admirer of famous women and an art collector who lived a fairly opulent life. I asked John Paul about another Lobo passion, Napoleon. Lobo had the largest collection of Napoleonica outside of France, items that were gradually sold off as he lived in exile after fleeing Cuba for Spain. I asked John Paul Rathbone what was behind Lobo's Napoleon fixation.
Well, I think it's important to start off that Lobo had important art collection as well. But what he was a casual shopper, shall we say, for his El Grecos, Titians, and Rembrandts. But when it came to Napoleonica, he was a connoisseur and an expert. And his library was the largest outside of France. It was staffed by four librarians who he sent to France to get the Napoleonic view, and then he sent them to England to get the Wellingtonian view. And Charles de Gaulle even complimented Lobo on the value of his collection and what it made to studies of the emperor. So this was a very serious collection, and it tells you a lot about a man who sought to project himself and his ambition through association through Napoleon. But this is again, it's not a man who would put on a sort of tricorn hat and push tin soldiers around on the green bays. I think he saw it as he saw Napoleon. There have been many Napoleons, but I think the Napoleon he admired was the administrator. And also the family man, collecting is a very interesting sort of psychological phenomenon. But I think one common characteristic of collectors often is that they are loners, and often they seek someone to admire, not necessarily to emulate. And Napoleon was someone for Lobo to admire because, well, there was a lot that he saw to admire in him.
And also exiled late in his life. Early in the book, you describe Lobo being called in the middle of the night to meet with Che Guevara, then the newly minted president of Cuba's central bank, who basically made an ultimatum to Lobo that forced him to leave the island. What did Che want?
Che, like everyone else, I think, in the Cuban government, and subsequently recognized Lobo's financial genius and talent. And Cuba was, and until very recently, remained a sugar exporting and producing country. And in the midst of so much change that came with the revolution, Che wanted to harness Lobo's talents. And they had this extraordinary interview at the Cuban Central Bank one night in October, just after the revolution, actually 18 months after, where Che asked Lobo if he would care to become minister of the sugar industry, which was a hugely important position. And they had a very interesting conversation filled with banter, although it was quite formal and polite. But in the end, Lobo declined, realizing perhaps too late, and filled as he was perhaps with Napoleonic grandeur, realizing too late that his Napoleonic dreams were over, that everything had come to an end, and really his empire was going to fold in on itself. And he didn't openly decline Che Guevara's offer, but 2 days later, after he gathered himself, he left the United States with, as he put it, just a toothbrush.
And left behind the El Greco paintings, left behind a vast amount of the Napoleon collection, did later recoup very little of it. But, you know, this sort of memory of Cuba as a place of power and wealth and high bourgeois life lives only in the memories of a certain sector of those who left the island, some of them very embittered and resentful expats. But very few other people have this picture of Cuba at that time. What do you think is most misunderstood by contemporary Americans, anyway, about Cuba before the revolution?
Well, perhaps one anecdote I can give you, and it's an English anecdote, but there was a minister in the British previous British government, who said that however bad Cuba might be, clearly it's better than it was. Now, this might be a very English point of view, but I think that's erroneous, that there, in fact, Cuba in the 1950s had more doctors per head than England. So just to give you a sense that, yes, Cuba was a skewed economy, but the social indicators were much more complex and nuanced than is often appreciated. And then from the U.S. perspective, clearly, which is quite a different one, sometimes it's Cuba is associated in the past with a home of rumba and free and easy living and cocktails and brothels and Maya Lansky, which is partly true, but that's the view from a tourist. And inside all this wealth and all these, in fact, rather sophisticated commercial operations, there was a very adept commercial class. The problem, of course, lay with politics. But that's a long story that goes back 100 years.
Well, how about for you personally? You were lulled to sleep as a child by your mother's stories of her life in Cuba growing up. You're among a generation of second-generation exiles whose parents, many are still deeply attached, many impoverished by the revolution. Their children maybe not so angry, but still carrying something, some memory of a place that no longer exists.
Well, that's right. And one part of my personal attempt in this book was to take some of those stories. I mean, Cuba is a home of exaggeration and tall stories, but there's always an element of truth in them. And I wanted to take some of these stories that I'd heard growing up and kind of strip them bare and then return them, cleansed to the best of my ability and verified and triple-checked. And you still get an extraordinary tale out of them. And what I think is important is to try and recover some sense of that past, partly because it's been exaggerated in the minds of exiles for whom, many of whom have only got glorious memories left because everything else has been taken away. And partly there's a deep interest also on the island. When I travel there, I find this. A lot of people are interested in what happened before the revolution because it's not a period, put it this way, it's a period that the revolutionary government has colored and perfumed in obvious ways and ideological ways that buttress its own case. So anything that I think brings the past to life can only be good because that can give you a better sense of perhaps where the future lies, especially now as Cuba is changing, as you said, into what and how and when, nobody knows. But without a sense of historical continuity, I think it's even harder to know where and how Cuba might become.
And that was our archive conversation with John Paul Rathbone, Latin American editor for the Financial Times and the author of The Sugar King of Havana, The Rise and Fall of Julio Lobo, Cuba's Last Tycoon.